This is Second Look, a look back at some of the stories and conversations from our newsroom this week. I'm Bob Levicky, WMRA's news director. It was week five of our Clean Virginia series, and Carol Lofton took a look at the legacy of mercury. A fish consumption advisory has been in effect for more than three decades on the South River and the South Fork of the Shenandoah River, from Waynesboro all the way to Front Royal. Kara took a look at why the advisory is still in place and what is being done to remedy the longstanding contamination.
On the banks of the South River and the South Fork of the Shenandoah River, one can see signs warning health advisory on eating fish. These fish may contain mercury in both Spanish and English. The signs are part of a monitoring program run by the Department of Environmental Quality, the Virginia Department of Health, and a DuPont-funded cleanup and monitoring initiative called the South River Science Team. The pollution dates back as early as the late 1920s, when a DuPont fabric factory produced rayon. The factory has since been sold to Invista. Mercury was used as a catalyst in the production of the fiber, a practice that was discontinued in 1950. But during those first 20 years or so, waste from the factory seeped into the soil around the plant, and then into the South River, the South Fork of the Shenandoah River, and part of the Shenandoah River itself. The mercury contamination went unnoticed for 26 years, until a DuPont construction team discovered mercury in the soil around the factory and notified regulation agencies of the finding. The next year, the Virginia Department of Health issued a fish consumption ban for more than 100 miles of stream bank stretching from Waynesboro to Front Royal. The ban was amended in 1980, but a fish consumption advisory remains in effect today. Little improvements have been seen in the mercury levels found in fish tissue over the last 40 years. So what's the problem with mercury?
Well, mercury is what they call a conservative substance. It does not degrade over time.
That was Don Kane of the Virginia Department of Environmental Quality. He said that once mercury gets into an ecosystem, it stays there because it can't be broken down like other chemicals.
Now, it can be moved, so it can be transported. It can be buried and made unavailable. But if it's in the system and it's actively working itself through the system, and that's basically what we see in South River and the South Fork of the Shenandoah River, it's in the ecosystem, it's in the invertebrates, it's in the fish, it's in the sediments, it's in the floodplain soils and along the riverbanks. So it basically just gets reworked and reintroduced and redeposited and restored in the river system.
Mercury likes to stick to soil particles. When soil is washed into the rivers, mercury goes with it and is carried downstream to contaminate areas far from the actual site of pollution. The stickiness of mercury makes removal of the chemical impractical, if not impossible, says Michael Liberati, project director for DuPont's corporate remediation group. So the South River Science Team is working on a containment, not removal, strategy.
The South River Science Team came up with the strategy of a riverbank stabilization, trying to contain the mercury rather than trying to excavate the mercury.
The plans are still being designed, but their goal is to stabilize
the first 2 miles of riverbanks that are eroding and have high mercury, and to institute a short-term and a long-term monitoring program to see if that remediation is effective. And if it is, we're likely to continue that on down the river.
In some cases, stabilization will just be vegetating the banks to keep them from eroding. In others, they might use engineered fabrics to keep the riverbanks in place. Liberati says the project is still being designed, but they hope to be in the field by this time next year. If the project is successful, it would mean not only healthier fish, but an overall healthier local ecosystem for everyone. For WMRA News, I'm Carol Lofton.
And if you want to get caught up, you can find the entire Clean Virginia series up to this point at WMRA.org. When Sweetbriar, a small women's college in central Virginia, abruptly announced it was closing in March, students and the alumni fought back against that decision. Last week, the Alumni Association, formed to save the school, aptly called Save Sweetbriar, won the battle to keep the school open, at least temporarily, and now they'll have an assist from a former Bridgewater College president. Carol Lofton reported that story.
In March, the Sweetbriar administration closed the 114-year-old school, citing insurmountable financial challenges. They said they wanted to let Sweetbriar close in dignity rather than eking out a limping existence for its last years. But former board member Christine Boulware, who left the Sweetbriar board in June of 2014, citing difference of opinion, said there were financial challenges, but they were certainly fixable given the right management.
For the last 2 years, we have not had a director of admissions, on top of which we did not maintain the relationships with the feeder schools that traditionally referred students to us.
She also said that for the last few years, 100% of Sweetbriar students received some form of financial aid, regardless of need. When she was on the board, Boulware assumed the money was coming from a scholarship fund. She later learned the money was actually being pulled from the endowment.
So it wasn't based on need or anything like that. It was just a practice that for some reason the admissions office chose to employ. So therefore, if you have 100% of your student body on either financial discount or financial aid, you're not receiving the full value of the tuition. So that is going to force us to draw down more on our endowment than we had planned.
Boulware is currently on the Save Sweetbriar Board, an alumna association that was formed following the March announcement. The group has managed to raise $21 million in the past 3 months, $12 million of which will go toward the school's operating costs for the coming year. The association also pushed the matter of the school's closing before the Virginia Supreme Court. On June 20th, a judge approved an agreement, fostered by Attorney General Mark Herring, to keep the school open for the coming year. The deal includes changes in leadership and overhaul of the current board, and will rely heavily on the money Save Sweetbriar raised to fund the coming year. These measures are really just a stopgap, though, for an institution that now has to scramble to find both students and faculty for a term that begins in less than 2 months. Teresa Tomlinson, mayor of Columbus, Georgia, and Sweetbriar's commencement speaker for the 2015 graduation, is optimistic about the future of the school, though. She said that the first day the deal was approved, they had more than 100 students inquire as prospective students or wanting to return to the school for the coming year.
I think that the tragedy of this proposed closing and the Herculean effort to turn it around has given us national exposure and name recognition that we did not have a year ago. And so I think that that's something that through this unfortunate circumstance has come to be in our favor.
Phil Stone, the former Bridgewater president who will step into the Sweetbriar role next week, agrees.
Out of curiosity, a lot of folks are looking at Sweetbriar who were not already looking at it, and including some prospective students. So part of what we'll be saying to them, almost as a marketing effort, to say, you see now what Sweetbriar women can do. Would you like to become one? So we think that's pretty effective in light of what they accomplished.
Stone, an attorney, served as Bridgewater's president for 16 years and shares a law practice in Harrisonburg with his children. The fact that he has already started and finished several successful careers at this point in his life may be one of the characteristics that make him ideal for the job. He said he's doing it because he believes in small liberal arts education, not because he was looking for work. Once the school is on its feet, he will happily pass the reins to someone else.
My job is to get it stabilized and make the transition to strength so that we can start recruiting another president. I do not have a contract. I have no idea what I'll be paid. We haven't discussed it. I usually do things on the basis of whether I feel some impulsion or urge or calling to do something. And that's the way I feel here, that if I have some experiences and some skills that might make it possible for me to help Sweetbriar survive, that's why I step forward.
It's a theme that ran through all three conversations. The alumna, students, and community members that are stepping forward to save the school are doing so not because they get something out of it, but because they deeply, passionately believe in the school itself and what it stands for. For WMRA News, I'm Carol Lofton.
Last Wednesday evening, the news leader fostered a community conversation at Stanton's City Hall. The gathering was called Roadmap to Reentry, and it was a follow-up to the paper's reporting in March on the struggles that many incarcerated women face when they're released from prison. I spoke with the news leader's Patricia Borns and with Nancy Insko. She's CEO of the Institute for Reform and Solutions in Stanton. It's an agency that works with these women. And I asked Insko about her takeaway from this first session.
I think we had a very good initial session. We were fortunate enough to have over 60 individuals attend through all channels of life. We had former offenders. We had officials. We had nonprofit agency directors. We had government officials. We had just citizens who were just really interested in the whole topic. We had relatives of offenders who are currently serving time and are struggling with solutions to, you know, address the reentry upon return of that family member. So it was a very good mix. Rarely do you get in one room such a diverse grouping of folks. So we, I think we shared information. There was a very strong contingency from Harrisonburg. Many of the individuals who were involved with Harvey Yoder who did attend and were able to divert the government in Rockingham and Harrisonburg from building a new facility. And they talked extensively about options, diversion, alternatives to incarceration. I personally have been dealing with alternatives to incarceration for, over 25 years in my 35-year history. And, you know, I'm a huge advocate of diversion at the front end, keeping people out of the system. And so I think that, you know, it was a good exchange. Part of our mission last night was to educate and to make the community aware that 99% of those who are in custody are going to come home. And so we need to have a community ready to support them so that they can be successful and not return to their former lifestyles. And when the obstacles are placed in their path, they get very frustrated. They're not financially stable. They don't receive the mental health treatment and the addictions treatment that they probably need, since at least 85% of all the correctional population has addictions or mental health issues. And so, you know, we even address the need of, you know, transportation so that they can, you know, participate in employment and be gainfully employed.
Right.
So, you know, just a whole litany of different things that hit the need button.
And from what I've been reading, the director of the Middle River Regional Jail was there talking about hiring a specialist for those reentering the system. Is that right?
The programs director, John Lilly, was in attendance. We understand that they have an advertised position now for a reentry specialist who will probably work under John, because John has been very interested in reentry. And so we look forward to coordinating with that individual so that we can start to program and plan at first day of incarceration, so we can plan for release and work with these folks during that period of incarceration.
Nancy, what are the biggest impediments to success for the people that you have case managed, and do you see some progress, and is some of that progress, do you think, coming out of these types of conversations?
Not a tremendous amount of progress yet. But as we push these dialogues and involve more and more folks, I anticipate that we will see issues such as, you know, lack of affordable housing, lack of sustainable employment, or ready access to mental health evaluation and treatment, you know, the absence of immediate and long-term addictions treatment, you know, the lack of transportation and education and vocational training, which is so needed to develop marketable skills that are consistent with the jobs throughout this region. You know, affordable childcare is a huge issue for these folks, particularly our women, who all have children. And they are reunifying with their children upon release. But affordable child care is a huge matter so that they can work and sustain their families. Basic life skills are just so lacking. Positive support systems out there like mentoring programs that would be enormously helpful because they have to have a support system, and many, many of them don't. Their families have rejected them or they haven't seen their families for years and years prior to their incarceration. The lack of problem-solving and organizational networking capabilities. They need more improved parenting skills. Their inconsistencies with their own knowledge of how to navigate an information technology environment, which is critical to job research, job application, and if they want to participate in education. So the whole matter of, getting oneself healthy, getting, these jobs with a skill level that can create a pathway for a career, not just a fast food 22-hour a week, inconsistent schedule. Those are some of the kinds of things that we so sorely need in this whole area. And the transportation problems are enormous because there's no public transportation here other than the trolley system, which has limited routes. And because they are released from jail owing a debt to the jail for per diems and medical costs, they owe court costs, fines, fees, and restitution. And until those are all satisfied, they cannot regain their driver's license. So this whole matter of transportation is one that's very complex. Child support. I mean, most women come out having to pay child support, and the Division of Child Support Enforcement gets in touch with them day one of their release and starts to pressure them around the payment of child support. If they don't set up those payments and they are not able to pay, then they are, chased down with a warrant and reincarcerated for lack of child support payment.
Right. Well, was there any movement in the conversation earlier this week that at least looked like we were making some progress in those areas?
I think there was an overture around some employment issues.
Now, were there state representatives there as well?
There was one gentleman who works in work development, I believe, at Augusta Correctional Center, who is a state employee. We did have the mayor of Stanton there last night, who was very supportive, and identified why these criminal justice system issues were so difficult, in her view. We had John Whitfield, Executive Director of Blue Ridge Legal Services, who did offer to assist in the management of these child support matters and the court cost fines and fees matters.
Right.
Now, that was a huge help to us. We have been now certified to actually bond our women after taking a course and are working with the Virginia Employment Commission around having the women who are in our program bonded, which makes them much more attractive to employers. And, so now the state offers some bonds to specific employers for hiring offenders upon release. The local governments don't have anything like that available, at least in Augusta County and our municipalities. So in our program, we are doing that bonding. And as we expand to program men, which is probably just around the corner, we will, of course, apply all of the elements of our program to working with males too at Middle River.
Patricia Bournes of The News Leader, your paper fostered these conversations. So where do they go from here?
It's clear that we need more of these informal discussions. We have a lot of Blue Ribbon panels, agencies talking to agencies. But what was so valuable about this was the sort of cross-section of people talking on an even playing field, officials not talking behind their desks, behind their titles. And so I think that breaking it down to more specific conversations, perhaps the faith community is really eager to be part of this and to help. And I think that they can develop ministries around mentoring and community service opportunities that would help people work off their debt. And so that sort of conversation I think would be valuable. Again, a transitional housing conversation that could draw in maybe the real estate community, and employment conversations that could involve local chambers of commerce and businesses to sort of work on that resistance to hiring offenders.
Well, Patricia, we look forward to hearing more of your reporting, and we're going to continue to follow this issue. Thanks very much for your time again.
Thanks, Bob, for being interested. Thank you.
And Nancy, thanks very much for your time also. I really appreciate the chance to talk with you today. Thank you.
It's a real pleasure, Bob, and thank you for your concern and thoughts about these issues.
Patricia Bournes is a reporter for the News Leader in Stanton, and Nancy Insko is the CEO of the Institute for Reform and Solutions, who works closely with many women making the transition from incarceration. You can find links to the News Leader's reporting through WMRA.org. Support for WMRA's News and Information Fund, which makes our coverage possible, comes from Bibb and Dolly Frazier, Eugene Stoltzfus, Janet Trentner, Rory and Jamie Kutaya, Joy Loving, Jim and Pam Huggins, and an anonymous donor. And you, too, can contribute to in-depth coverage of issues, events, and people in our community. Find out more about the News and Information Fund at WMRA.org, where you'll also find all of our stories from the newsroom. Be sure to like us on Facebook at WMRA Public Radio for a heads up on our coverage. And you can follow me on Twitter at WMRA Bob. I'm Bob Levicky, WMRA's news director and morning edition host. I'll see you in the morning.